Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Tech Connect podcast. I'm John Martin.
And I'm Dean Reverman.
Dean, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening last year. You know, a pandemic.
Oh, you mean that? Yeah. Whole pandemic thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you know there was an election last year also?
I heard there was no election.
Wasn't really a big deal. You know,
I may have
really
saw a blip
about
on my news feed. Something about an election.
Something about it. Yeah. We might have only talked about it for a few months, you know. So, but hey, you know, we have wanted to kind of talk a little bit about government.
Government.
Because
the
government world and selling into the government world for our resellers is, you know, a different kind of beast than just going out and selling to retail or hospitality or
100%.
Manufacturing, whatever.
You ever feel like government is like this monolith out there that's just like this thing, right? And it's like, how do I get into that? Anyway.
Like with the...
So
that brings us to our topic today. We are going to talk a little bit about the government space. And I suspect that we have a lot of resellers that also feel that way about it, that it's a monolith.
Yep.
Maybe they already do sell into it, but it's still something that's always intimidating. Or maybe they're not sure if they want to get into that world and they're unsure about it. So we have with us today Jeff Smith. He is a consultant in this industry, knows a lot about the reseller world and what they do, as well as the government space.
Just a little bit. Jeff is like a guru. I'm going to call him a guru.
Right.
He's awesome at this. So you have got to tune into this one. Yeah.
Good. So we're going to talk about the new administration, obviously.
Yep.
What does that mean when you're selling in the government?
Sure.
You know, changing priorities. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to start off a new year in the government space? Anyway, we're going to get into a couple specific topics like cybersecurity, cloud security, how that's kind of impacting the space right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe, you know, talk a little bit about what's happening like the state, local, and education levels too. So
all
that plus our usual value to the VAR and what's tech connecting with us. It is time to plug in and get connected.
Welcome to the Tech Connect podcast. It's time to get connected.
All right. So as I mentioned, our guest today, Jeff Smith. Jeff is the president of True Upside Consulting and is a consultant for Zebra in particular, who, you know, obviously we do a lot of business with.
Oh, yeah.
One of our founding sponsors here at Tech Connect. Jeff, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of your day-to-day job there at True Upside, and maybe kind of, you know, understanding of why you are such a guru for all things government and the reseller space. No pressure, but, you know.
Yeah.
No, thanks so much. Thrilled to be here. This is obviously highly topical for our VARs and our partner community. Our firm is, we're on year 14 now, and what we do at the, you know, kind of the least common denominator phase is help people win contracts with agencies, whether it be SLED or the federal government. Many of our folks at Zebra and Blue Star know that I started my career in state government, working for the president of the Senate in Florida, and then spent 3 years on the Hill working for Senator Bob Graham. And so I've been in public sector sales and in that public sector educational side for almost 30 years now. And so it's what we do every day. We help people decode and find ways to profitably win contracts and programs and opportunities with public sector agencies.
Awesome.
Yeah, and what we love about Jeff is the fact that he, to his point, not just the federal, but SLED also. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's opportunities out there, and it's across the gamut. And we'll get into it here today, but great broad reach there.
Definitely. And if you're watching the video portion, Jeff looks like he's in an amazing tropical setting.
Yes, he does.
I know it's probably an illusion, but it still just makes me excited for time on the beach. Whenever we can get back there, we here in this tri-state area, honestly, let's be honest, most of the country has been dealing with a lot of terrible winter storms of late. This is late
February.
Like
60%, there was 60% of the U.S. was under snow.
Yeah, exactly.
Like last week. Yeah,
so I appreciate that, even though I'm envious of just the background, even though I know you're not really there, I'm still envious of it, and it just makes me long for, you know, better days ahead.
There you
go. Well,
goodbye.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Jeff, thank you again for being here. You know, I kind of want to kick things off by, you know, this idea of, you know, where do we start in 2021, and especially with a new administration? So obviously the Biden administration has taken over, and anytime a new, you know, a new administration takes over, they've got different priorities for, you know, what's important to them, what they're going to put funding and money into. And we know this is an administration that is, you know, pretty heavily inclined into things like climate change. There's a lot to be done right now, obviously, around healthcare, and I'm sure that's going to very much impact the technology world and the technology that is needed in the government and public sector space. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about that new administration idea. And you know, what are VARs going through right now as they're preparing for a new year and thinking about, hey, how do I tackle a government space with not just a new administration, but just a new year in general?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it really is a new day. And when there's an administration change, especially one of this nature, there are lots of things that need to be adjusted from a sales approach standpoint. A recent survey looked at the four opportunities or the four key takeaways of how to transition, or what people in our IT environment and market vertical thought was the best way to transition with this new administration. One is human capital, right? Obviously, we will probably enlarge the size of our federal employee base. The Biden administration is already working very, very swiftly to get leadership in place for all the appointed officials at the agency level. So human capital is really, really going to be important. The other thing is programs. We know we've got the Stimulus Act that just recently went to the Senate as early as this morning. And the programs associated with the Stimulus Act and that incremental funding create great incremental opportunity for our partners to follow that money, follow that funds, those funds, chase that dollars. The third is policies. What policies are going to be impacted by the administration change and the new leadership at the appointed level? Obviously, when there's policy shaped or changes or creations, that is another opportunity for us to sell. And then the last is relationships, right? We, you know, especially at the higher levels within the agency, we've got to start building new relationships with the new appointees and their key, you know, stakeholders, because those are, they're different. They've changed, and they're very, a lot of the appointees have a Biden, Obama background and feel. So we can probably open up our sales approach manuals from that administration and get a little bit ahead, but we've got to capitalize on those four things, and we've got to move quick, especially as far as building relationships with these new appointees and senior cabinet officials.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, when you think about it, and I think that starts to tap into why some resellers find the government so frustrating to sell into.
Intimidating.
I mean, now you've got like a whole new group of people that you have to interface with. I like the fact, you know, what you said there, Jeff, dust off the playbook of the old Obama administration and the, you know, the sales tactics that we used then and we got to use now. Really fascinating, though. I mean, it just selling into the government's kind of unlike anything else out there, right?
Definitely. I mean, have to think so, yeah.
Because of all the things that he just mentioned, policy changes, program changes, ebbing and flowing of human capital coming in and out. Now we're going to bump up and the relationships that you build.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Jeff, you mentioned the COVID relief bill, obviously. And a big part of this, there's, you know, we always know when these bills come out, there's always so many different little packages and riders and little things that are kind of tucked in along the way.
Little things, big things.
Well, yeah, little things are big things. You know, we're talking billions of dollars. I guess it's more than
trillions.
Just
we're
little
in the
things.
Trillions
right.
now. All right.
So I know that one, and we were actually just talking about this before we started recording, is the Technology Modernization Fund, or TMF, which was a $9 billion fund that Biden had floated to be part of this COVID relief package. But I understand from you that just this morning, this is February 24th as we're recording this, it was pulled out of the package, but may end up back in there later. So tell us a little bit about what this fund is for, why it's, you know, so important, and what, you know, and definitely it. To me, it sounds like something that would be a huge impact.
I think it still exists, right?
Well, it does.
It's just a matter that the current bill would bump it up significantly.
Yeah. Okay. So explain what the fund is, basically, why it is so important that we do, you know, get some additional funding, and if you think it's going to come back around to boost it again.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It got pulled out of the bill. The House has finished their analysis with the bill. As Dean said, it's $1.9 trillion, but there, under the Trump administration, there were a lot of what you would call housekeeping type of procurements outside of the budget and programs that got tied into the stimulus bill because they weren't passed and or were deferred for such a long period of time that they tagged it onto the stimulus bill. So the $1.9 trillion is also a reflection of the administration change because there are certain programs and deferred legislation that didn't go through under the Trump administration been tied to the Stimulus Act. Now, the part of it that we're the most excited about is obviously Technology Modernization Fund, which is, as you said, around $9 billion. It's all about modernizing federal IT and also leveraging emerging technologies to improve the security posture of our government. Mm-hmm. And part of that will go to state and local, obviously. And a lot of it, though, will be incremental funding that, once again, we've got to follow that money. If you look at the federal IT budget, it's around $82 to $88 billion annually, and that's $9 billion. So that's a 10% increase in spending that we need to take advantage of, find the money, find the programs, and get ahead of that for our partners.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's so true in the sense that, you know, when and as I was listening to you talk, Jeff, and one of the things that just drives me crazy about the government. Okay, so I don't live in government. Right. I don't really sell into government. But, man, I mean, I'm looking at like the note from the CIO, the chief CIO for on cloud computing, one of the articles mm-hmm. that you were noting in the lead up to this. It's just it's very government type of the way that it's written.
Yeah.
But I guess you kind of have to know how to navigate that environment and that world, because there's opportunities. Now, when you look at the TMF, even though it exists today, there are certain things that they're prioritizing around, you know, right, around cloud computing, security, with some of the recent things that have happened out in the marketplace. But I was also interested to read this article about, to your point, Jeff, you hit it right. Your first bullet point was human capital and staffing. They're even, you know, talking about the importance to bring on, you know, staffing that is competent, you know, that is leading. They need to be able to fund, you know, mm-hmm. so that you can pay the people the competitive salary to come work for the government on behalf right. of them and stuff like that. So it is really kind of fascinating, that aspect of it.
Yeah,
you know, it's just the government is so broad reaching.
It is. And, you know, and I think we've all kind of experienced at some point in our life the slowness of government
mm-hmm. yeah,
and
right.
the epic crawl that it seems to happen just to get anything to happen, and which is, again, a reason why I don't know that I would be able to handle selling into that space, knowing mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. you might be able to approach them with, hey, I've got
patience.
Great technology. I know this is what you need. You're talking about modernizing. You're talking about updating your IT and making things better. Here's everything you need. And by the time the funding comes through, or by the time they're all yeah. the people who need to sign off and agree in committees that things have to go through, you're already like six iterations of technology potentially beyond that.
You're in version 3.0. Yeah.
Exactly. That has to be just exhausting to think about. Yeah. Yeah. Well, then, you know, because I know we want to kind of come back and talk a little bit more about, you know, just how you approach those kind of conversations.
Yeah,
maybe we'll
right.
save that towards a little bit later in
yeah.
the conversation.
Yeah.
But I think I want to start with, you referenced cybersecurity and cloud mm-hmm. security as being mm-hmm. two top high priorities right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as I was doing some research around that, obviously I was reminded of the whole SolarWinds hack that
right?
happened last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know when we think of, you know, cybersecurity and foreign attacks, you know, on our government,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of talk has been come up about election integrity, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, we had some very serious hacks of government, you know,
absolutely.
Sites and software.
Intellectual property, yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So this has to be a priority, obviously, because, you know, that's a critical need that you just can't leave open out there.
It keeps us sovereign.
A priority right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty big.
And then obviously on the cloud side of that too, and I think the piece that I came across from it's literally cloud.cio.gov strategy
mm-hmm.
section
mm-hmm.
about federal cloud computing, which is the tagline for this is from cloud first to cloud smart,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a smart way of kind of referring to the understanding, like, hey, we know we need the cloud, but we also need to understand what that means
yes.
and how to keep that secure as well.
Because it's evolving. The
is.
Definition of the cloud is evolving. And I
right.
thought that article did a pretty good job of that. But yeah.
Definitely. So, yeah. Jeff, from your perspective then, can you help us kind of differentiate a little bit between, you know, the two concepts of cybersecurity versus cloud security? And what does that mean to our VARs and how they should position themselves and their hardware and their strategies when talking about those things?
Well, it's highly topical. Again, it's, you know, security posture at all endpoints is imperative because the attacks coming from our foreign enemies are pervasive. They are daily. They don't stop. It is a technology war, if you will, and it's very, very serious. So a recent survey of government IT officials said 72% of senior IT government officials in public sector believe their security posture is at risk. 72%.
Wow.
41% said that they weren't prepared for the pandemic. They didn't have technologies that could support the workforce in a secure and effective way for the pandemic. And they're still, the 42% is still not there. Mm-hmm. So this is a great opportunity for our partner community. When you look at cybersecurity, what you're looking at is endpoints into your network, right? And that can also include insider threat, right? So anything that comes in and out of your network, anything from an even an insider threat standpoint, the way people are authenticated in the network, the way applications are partitioned for secure and non-secure, the way classified and non-classified networks interact with each other, all endpoints are a risk, right? They're a threat. When you look at cloud security, right, what you're looking at is you're transitioning your fixed data center environment into a cloud. And that could be done in a hybrid cloud, could be done in a private operated cloud or a public cloud. And there's a certification called FedRAMP that most application providers and solution cloud service providers have to have in order to be certified to manage government information in a cloud network. And so what you have to look at on the cloud side is you look at what part of your data center or your operating center are you going to move to a cloud environment, and how do you keep it secure, and is it FedRAMP certified, and how does that create a higher security posture and a more efficient processing power for the agency? Cloud first, as you said, was the first start. Agencies had to bring forward one part of their key operating environment. A lot of people did email. A lot of agencies used email as a platform or as a service to migrate to cloud. And now it's cloud smart. FedRAMP, the FedRAMP certification and criteria is a part of cloud smart. And you're not going to see, you're very rarely going to see data center investment at this point. You may see some refresh. You may see some legacy systems in the VA that can only be supported because they have some legacy systems that have been around for 30 years. But you, for the most part, you're going to see when processing power needs to occur, or especially a new application needs to be entered into your environment. And that's where the innovation is happening, is application as a service. Mm-hmm. And that's really exciting for the agencies, because legacy systems always plagued, the integration with legacy systems always slowed down the implementation phase, right? So, think of cybersecurity as any endpoint, and any endpoint is access endpoint or network endpoint, anywhere, any place that someone logs into a network is at risk. Think of cloud security as the security posture of what you migrate out of your fixed environment into some type of cloud environment.
Gotcha. And help us out a little bit more on the FedRAMP certification. Do you need that certification, Jeff, to do state, local, and education, or SLED as well? Or is that just a federal certification to handle federal data?
Ever-changing. It's a great question. So FedRAMP 2.0 is in process. Mm. And what it really is going to do on the federal side is hopefully bring a shorter acquisition cycle to the certification, because right now it takes around 9 to 12 months to get it. As far as SLED goes, they haven't adopted FedRAMP, but they have adopted things like supply chain risk management and ANA, what's called authentication and accreditation packages. And we see in the, because we support around 40 or 50 major procurement proposals every year, we see SCRM, ANA, FedRAMP-like requirements in state and local. And then we, on the federal side, it's kind of starting to become the de facto standard that they feel safe with. Doesn't mean that you always have to have it. If it's platform as a service, it's certainly required. application or software as a service, it's not always required in federal. But I do believe at some point, the state and local entities will adopt the FedRAMP program because it's safe for them, right? It's safe for them to use, and somebody else has already done the work to get the accreditation. If not, there'll be parts of the FedRAMP components that'll be necessary for you to certify it, to win procurements and programs and opportunities.
And maybe we can dive into that a little bit more, but kind of getting back to the cybersecurity cloud, issue, it's interesting. Another article we were reading in prep to this, when you look at the priorities of what is happening or what has been stated by CIOs that play in state and things like that, cloud solutions, right? At the top of the list there, security enhancement tools, number five in this top 10. So two of the top fives are what we were just talking about, cloud solutions, security enhancement tools of some sort. Very, very top of mind when it comes to any kind of government. Those two are playing into that. So, a reseller really, I think your question here, John, is really good. How do they position themselves into that marketplace? Mm-hmm. Are you going to position yourself more on the cybersecurity side, or on the edge devices, or is the cloud in that? So that was really good commentary there.
Yeah. And Jeff, I also liked when you kind of talked at the beginning of some of the statistics you tossed out there about, 70-odd% of these executives who felt like, hey, we don't feel very secure. We think there is an issue here. But I think even the more interesting one that we don't think about in quite the same way from our perspective as someone in a government perspective has to, which is that 41% that weren't prepared for the pandemic. And we think about, hey, the pivot to work from home was, challenging, but in our world, it's not a huge deal. We get to go sit in our office at home or wherever we are. Mm-hmm. We tap into a VPN and we can still access all of our work stuff. We're not as concerned about massive security. It's not as big of a deal. If I'm playing in a Google Sheet and putting down, what's next on the Tech Connect podcast.
Yeah,
I'm not that concerned about that being in the cloud and how secure that is. If someone wants to find that, whatever, they know what our next episode's about. Not a big deal.
I doubt there's a Russian hacker out there saying, golly, if I only knew what they were doing next on Tech Connect.
Exactly. I mean, it'd be cool, I guess, if we were that interesting, but we're not. So that has to be an entirely different world, though, for
government.
For government people, in the public sector, where it's not as simple as just like, okay, go home and do the same work. Well, if your work involves a lot of classified material, a lot of sensitive data. It's not as simple as just plugging in a VPN and going to town. You've got to be much more cautious and secure about that. Yeah. And again, if we're living in this world now where we assume that work from home, remote work, is going to be part of the future, for government people to get there,
sure,
it's a whole different level that you have to think about. And I think that could be a great talking point for me as a VAR if I was going to somebody and say, hey, how did things go last year when you had to pivot to work from home or if you were able to at all? How did that work out for you? What were you struggling with? Where were the problem pain points? Where are there still pain points? And that could be a nice little in to start opening up this conversation.
Would
you agree with that, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great first question to ask. And, any open-ended question like that about how has the pandemic affected the mission? What technologies are you looking at to enable the mission in this pandemic-like situation that we're in? The other thing is you have to think about is culturally, especially for the Department of Defense agencies, they're all about command and control, right? So they're used to looking at people in the eyeball and shaking them down and having, one-on-one discussions. And so there's also a change management piece where I think technology can be an enabler as well. So it's a great question to ask, how's your security posture changed or become more vulnerable with the pandemic? How's your culture? How's it affected your culture, your people, the way you run your agencies, the way you run your meetings, the way you do your daily lives? And what technologies are you looking at that can enable the mission further in this environment?
Yeah, definitely.
So all great questions.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to say, if we pivot over to the SLED side a little bit, if you're ready to do that, we've kind of referenced it a few times already that there can be slightly different priorities on the SLED side of things at the state and local level than federal. And Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I would assume that things can move a little bit quicker at the state and local level sometimes than in the federal level, where there's probably more layers of complication to get something done. Would you say that is the case?
Yeah, the procurements are simpler. They're more streamlined. They have the more, ability to sole source more. They have the ability to look at the student first and the technologies that enable the student. And they have the ability to implement platforms that are viable for, you know, the educator. Mm-hmm. And so the procurements do move quicker. A really interesting thing as a part of the research for this is when the last stimulus package was approved, the state and local IT budgets went up by 13%.
Jeez, that's big.
On average, since 2000, they've gone up by 4% annually. And so, you know, I believe that we're going to see a big trickle down from the stimulus package into SLED IT buys and strategical buys. And I also think, as you said, the acquisition cycle will be shorter than it is for a large federal program.
Yeah.
And maybe now, go ahead. Maybe there we can dive in a little bit, Jeff, because I'd love to hear your opinion on this, on tips on selling into government. And let's start at the state and local level, because I think, honestly, that seems maybe a little bit more approachable than the monolith that is the federal government. Mm-hmm. We'll get there in a second, but let's start off with state and local. What are your, let's get down to the 101 basic level, right? Just some basic advice you would give to a reseller who's not selling into that space right now. What are your maybe top three tips that you would give a reseller who's a technologist out there today? You know, they're putting in solutions for asset tracking or you name it, or maybe it's even point of sale systems and stuff like that. That's our customer base. What are your top three tips for trying to get into that state and local type of business opportunities?
It's a great question. I think the first thing that you have to realize when you go after public sector contracts, programs, and opportunities is that the sales process is different than it is in commercial, right? In commercial, it's more about relationship building with the key people in an organization that are the ultimate decision makers. In the public sector, whether it be state and local or federal, there's always three people involved unless it's a sole source opportunity, which is fairly rare. One is the program. The people that run the programs for the technology and support the technology throughout its life cycle. And so you want to have, obviously, really good relationships with the tactical people that run the programs. The second constituency that you have to have a great relationship with is the senior IT officials and decision makers. And sometimes in public sector, those are lower in the organization than they are in commercial, right? So a lot of federal CIOs are more figureheads and let's have people in for lunch and talk about stuff. But, you know, I've got other people that actually do the daily work for the agency. So sometimes you got to remember that you're speaking to a CIO in public sector that may not be a doer. They may be more of a figurehead, well-intended, of course, but more of a figurehead. So when you're talking to the IT person, which is the second person you really have to have a great relationship with or a strong relationship with, you need to ensure that it's a doer and that it's somebody that is absolutely able to make a program work, not just talk about a program, right? Because they love to talk about cool stuff they want to do, but, you know, is it funded? And then the last person that you really need or constituency you really need to have a great relationship with is the contracting or procurement officer, right? Because at some point, most public sector opportunities are going to be competed in some way. And if you don't know the contracting officer and you don't know the procurement path and you don't understand where how the funds are being allocated, where it's going to be competed, then you have lost a huge part of opportunity intelligence that you need to be successful. So the last thing I would say is we want to have great relationships with all three constituents, right? With the right people, the doers. And then lastly, we want to be early, right? There's a continuum in any public sector sale or contract or procurement. It all starts with an idea on the left, and then at some point it becomes an award, right? And there's 100 things that happen between idea and award. The more we understand that, the more endpoints we understand between idea and award, the more influence we have over those three constituencies, the more profitable and successful we're going to be. So, you know, those are really, you know, doing this for almost years and being able to, work on the government side. I've also ran a $300 million VAR for their public sector vertical. I 50 companies and run large public sector organizations. It really comes down to that. And yeah. one of the more recent dynamics, just to close out, mm-hmm. is the contracting officer has a much higher sphere of influence now on the award than they ever have. When technology was just starting to get, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and technology was starting to evolve, you always wanted to talk to the technologist because they could kind of pull anything over on a contracting officer. Yeah, we need this huge server, right? Oh, yeah, I need 1,000 thin and light laptops for my tenured professors. But now the procurement officials are IT savvy. And so they control, from a sphere of influence standpoint, they control a huge part of how things are awarded, competed, and who actually gets any type of favorable, obviously legal, but favorable shake in the evaluation process. And so that is a new dynamic that we all have to remember. Contracting officers are people too. And we have to have great relationships with them. And if we don't, then we really risk not being able to get an opportunity closed.
Man, there's all kinds of gold in what he just said.
Very much so.
Can I unpack just a little bit of that
real quick?
Please, because great. Thank you, Jeff, for that insight. And I was reverting back to a previous life where I sold for a reseller, and we did have government opportunities. And when you talk about the three people involved, I was with you, you know, the program people. Again, I'll refer back to, is a digital signage solution that was being put into a convention center that's run by the government, right? So we had the program people. Amen. You got to have those people, the people that are going to be tasked with facilitating whatever was, in this case, it was digital signage. So as you know, the people putting the messages on the board and having to run it on a day-to-day basis, they were in the decision-making process. Senior IT officials, yes. But to Jeff's point, it wasn't the person at City Hall that's the CEO, whatever, the CIO for here locally in Cincinnati government, mm-hmm. but it was the doer, you know, the person below that's the one who's not running the cable, but they know where all the servers are. They're doing the updates and stuff like that. That person was involved in the conversation. But where I want to dive a little bit further, because where we didn't, even though we did win the deal, I didn't have a relationship with the contracting officer, and I didn't know the procurement path. Jeff, where does that happen? Is that at City Hall? Is that where those people live? If you're in a local government, or if you're at the state level, you got to go up to the state house, and that physically is where these people are, the procurement people. Unlock that world for us a little bit.
No, great. Excuse me. Great question. The long answer or short answer is it depends.
Okay.
But so you really, sometimes you have to do, when you're creating a relationship with the IT and program folks, you really have to ask those extra questions, right? Who is the contracting or procurement officer assigned to this? The last opportunity that was sold on this, how was it purchased? Was it purchased off a state contract? Was it purchased off a GSA contract? Was it purchased off a large IDIQ contract in federal? And do you know the contracting or procurement officer that's going to be assigned to this opportunity? So sometimes you have to do a little bit of a hunting lesson. And before, another really important thing to do is, once something is posted, if it's posted in the pre-RFP stage, it's more than likely funded, right? And it's more than likely got one or several contracting officers attached to it. And at that point, they can talk to you because it's not an active competition. So it's important for you to create a rapport with that person. Our company is very interested in this. We're going to put we're making every effort to put in a competitive bid with you. Is it okay if I speak with you, if I see something about the procurement that I think the government may have not intended, right? And start building a rapport. We had a really major win in FAA last year, one of our biggest wins in the history of our firm. And on the front end of the procurement, I called the contracting officer on behalf of the client, and I said, you know, feedback from industry, you've awarded to the same three companies the last 15 years, every 5 years. Is this an open competition or not? And, you know, there's a pause. And I said, hey, just feedback from industry. He goes, we're open to competition. And I said, great, then you're going to get some great competition. And our client, who had not won the bid the previous three times, wins it and displaces one of the three incumbents that have been there for 15 years. And obviously it was very, very large contract. But the point is that building a rapport legally at the right times, asking the right questions, and also, you know, the contracting officers love feedback from industry. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of time talking to contracting and procurement officials on behalf of our clients before competitions come out, right? To ensure that they do compete it the right way. Because if they don't, and you're the right solution, right, you've lost the opportunity. So the original question, Dean, is, yeah, sometimes you have to do a hunting. You got to go hunting, and you got to ask questions to the other two constituencies. And then sometimes, you know, once it's published as either a pre-RFP or a pre-solicitation, you need to create a rapport with that individual, right, by asking the right questions and making them aware of who you are.
So I can already tell we're going to have to do multiple government selling podcasts.
Yeah, this won't be the only one.
There's just too much to unpack here,
yeah,
you know, because just the RFP process, you know, I made a note there, Jeff, and let's just go a little bit further in here on something, because the RFP process is unique, right? I mean, most people that are working in the citizen world, you know, commercial world, you typically don't have as buttoned up of an RFP process as comes out of the government. I mean, it can be very intimidating to receive this, whatever, 50-page RFP document for, you know, a solution that needs to be implemented. And there's just, it seems like a lot of red tape. I know, because I was there. I lived that world. I had to answer these RFPs because I was in sales and marketing. That's what, you know, that's what you do. You come up with your answer to it. But Jeff, anything, and let's stay at the state and local level, not the federal level, but do you have, I think you just walked through beautifully, you know, part of the RFP process. Any other tidbits to give our audience here about the RFP? You know, does it really matter, for example, how well written it is and if it's in the same font as what's been, I mean, what are just some of the things that you've learned over the years about responding to an RFP that you could parlay over to our audience?
Well, compliance, two words, you have to be compliant with the requirement. Mm-hmm. And two, you have to be compelling against the evaluation criteria. The biggest mistake that we, when we take on a procurement for a client, is that they get into marketing mode and they start talking about how cool they are or how cool their technology is or how cool their solutions are and how great their people are. And everybody gives great customer service, right? But the evaluator, when they sit down to read the document, will have a scorecard. The scorecard will be based on the evaluation criteria of the procurement. And if they can't populate that scorecard with strengths and proof points against the evaluation criteria, you're not going to score well. And you also have to realize many of these source evaluation boards are taking this on as an extra assignment, right? Because the contracting officer will evaluate the administrative part of the bid and the price, but technical, managerial, they'll do past performance, corporate experience will be done usually by a source evaluation board. And that is not their sole job. It's an extra assignment, right? And they're sitting in a room, they've got 100 binders and they're going through them. Dean, they would love to kick you out for compliance. There's a famous one about 2 years ago where a systems integrator turned in a $140 million Air Force task order bid, and they didn't, their glossary of acronyms was incomplete, and they got kicked out for compliance. So, because government didn't want to read another bid, right? So,
can you imagine all those man hours burned and then they got kicked out of the RFP?
Yep.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
No, my point to your original is you have to be compliant first. You have to have compelling content against the evaluation criteria. And the other really important thing is, you have to be able to walk away from a big opportunity, right? If you really can't win it, if you don't have the past performance, if you have compliance gaps, either try to negotiate in good faith at the right time with the government to influence the requirement or move on to the next one, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of times the bids that we see are kind of what I would call drive-by bids that sales organizations fall in love with the opportunity, but they don't successfully assess compliance and past performance and the ability to have some sizzle against the evaluation criteria.
Yeah. Oh,
gold.
There are two main points I want to address here, and mm-hmm. both of them are to reference our audience back to previous podcasts. plug. Because one, we had our first podcast this year, first like one with a guest, was all about deep selling and account penetration with Luke.
Yep.
And I remember Luke's first thing out of his mouth was, people buy from people. Mm-hmm. One of the fundamental principles of selling.
Yeah.
So I think when we talk about that idea, we've been talking about it already, this idea of like having these relationships, you're going to get a better foot in the door if you are someone that people know and trust and understand.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the flip side of that, go back to our effective sales presentations podcast from last year,
mm-hmm.
where we talked about the idea that if you are, let's say, someone who doesn't have that relationship yet, and you're going in and you're trying to pitch yourself and pitch, and again, maybe in this RFP type context as a company, I like what you mentioned, this idea of like, hey, let's talk about how cool all of our stuff is. A good, effective sales presentation is one where you walk in the door and you say, listen, I understand what I know about what you're trying to do and what you want to accomplish. Here's what you need. Here's what we have that meets those needs. And here's where those connecting points are.
Mm-hmm.
Here's why we should be working together on this.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about all that fluff,
yeah, right.
your company culture or all the other cool stuff you're doing or what you're launching next year.
They don't care how cool it is.
That is not important, especially in this context where, like you said, there's binders and binders sitting in front of them. They're looking for any reason to toss one out the door. And if your presentation and your response is filled with fluff, mm-hmm. that's it. They don't want to deal with you.
They don't even care. It's not even a part of the process.
It's not important.
I think he's really illustrated, I think, very eloquently, just the facts, right?
Yep.
Let's just boil this down to the facts. You want to get into the door so that you can have the conversation. And I like where you're going, Jeff. And I think a lot of people don't understand is kind of the pre-bid process. And I think we got to do a podcast on that because there's a deeper dive about how to get kind of tapped into that ecosystem so that you understand opportunities that are coming down the line and you can be in that phase. But to your point, John, yes, as we talked about, people buy from people, right? Yeah. Even contract people at the government are people.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Even if it seemed like that, like you said, that monolithic entity,
yeah,
right. there's still people behind that.
There's a dude
in the
office.
They're not unfeeling robots.
No, with 100 binders that probably, and I didn't know, is probably tasked with something completely different than what he or she now has to do, which is evaluate the very basics of these responses. Wow. Really, fascinating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation. And as you've said, Dean, we're going to have to come back to Jeff to talk. We've actually got a laundry list of other government topics, and I think Jeff's going to be the perfect guy to go through a lot of those mm-hmm. with us. So you can expect to hear him back on the podcast at some point again this year, especially as we move through the year. I know the buying journey and the cycle of government and public sector moves across different thresholds throughout the year where they might be more inclined to start working on something or funding might come in at
right.
certain
times. Right, the timing, their fiscal is completely different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. we're going to rely on you to help us out with figuring out, hey, where does the timing fit in that we need to have a conversation about a certain time of year. So we definitely expect to have you back to talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you. And seasonality is key. And on that, from a sense of urgency standpoint,
mm-hmm.
Last year there were 603 major procurements completed in the state and local IT arena. The forecast this year is 800. So, and their fiscal year ends June 30. So you're communication plan, your calling plan, your relationship plan for building relationships with the right constituents needs to be going on now.
Yeah, right now.
Partners need to be looking for pre-RFP opportunities that are going to be awarded between now and June 30 and do everything they can to create those relationships we talked about earlier and take advantage of the increased competition in that vertical between now and June 30.
Definitely. All right. Well, then before we wrap up with our recurring segments, I want to first of all, as always, thank our TechConnect sponsors, Elo, Epson, Honeywell, and Zebra. We appreciate your support of our show. Listen, if you have any kind of questions, if you want to reach out to us and give us a little bit of insight into your world with government, or maybe have a question we could pass along to Jeff to get answered, mm-hmm. You can always, first of all, give us a 5-star rating review on Apple Podcasts.
Yep. Easy to do.
We're
going to
keep asking
now.
For it until you all do it. Which means we're always going to be doing it.
There you go,
apparently.
Right, yeah.
Just seriously, if you're listening on a mobile device right now, open up your podcast app. Just
hit the little 5-star. Yeah.
Yeah, find those little stars.
Really
press
easy.
The number 5.
There
if you,
you
want to leave a review, great. We might even read some on air. If not, it's fine. Just give us the 5 stars at least.
There you go.
We know you've been listening to this long time on the show. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. That's at TechConnectPod. And you can email us, techconnect@bluestarinc.com. All right. Well, let's wrap up, as always, with our recurring segments. Value to the VAR is where we always start. Mm-hmm. This is where we like to kind of wrap up our conversation into a package and answer a question that kind of, you know, is a takeaway for our VAR audience. Jeff, obviously, I'll let you start here. My question today is, you know, tell us something. I think you've kind of hinted at this a little already, especially right before our break there, that what is something that our government VARs need to be doing right now to get a leg up and to create a path to success as they move throughout 2021?
It's a great question. You know, the we've already talked about state and local. Take advantage of the incremental funding that's going to be funded through the stimulus package probably in the next couple of weeks. Make sure your bid and proposal and sales organizations are very aggressively communicating with state and local buyers across the three contingencies that we talked about earlier. And then on the federal side, you know, it's all about follow the money. If the Technology Modernization Fund gets thrown back in by the Senate, which I believe it will. I believe that the new president really wants the TMF as a part of this package. It's one of the showstoppers. Surprised that the House pulled it, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Senate puts it back in there. We're looking at about a 7% federal IT budget increase plus the Technology Modernization Fund. And we're looking at a seasonality, as everyone knows, the federal buying season ends at September 30, and they award and compete most of their opportunities between August 15th and September 30th. So it's about resource alignment, it's about sales strategy, it's about relationship building, and it's about making the right decisions about going after opportunities that you can win and that you can win profitably. If you do those things across those two verticals, it's probably going to be a great year for your public sector sales organizations.
Yeah. Awesome. And remember my value to the VAR, you know, remember the transitions that we talked about, the human capital that's going on right now across Fed and SLED programs. Understand the programs that are out there and those that have the opportunity of getting funded, how policies affect that. And then finally, the relationship build that Jeff was just talking about. Really good stuff. We can help as well over at Blue Star. We do have a VAR Gov program. Jeff's involved in it. Brian Ray, who's our government lead as well, is involved in it. So if you need help, you can reach out to us. Navigating that world, understanding what RFPs are out there and things like that, we've got some resources that we can help with you. I mean, we're tapping into RFPs that are getting listed all the time. So we've got certain tool sets that we can bring to the table to help resellers who are genuinely interested in getting into. We didn't talk a lot about federal today, and maybe that's another podcast, but we've got some tools that can help there. So the value to the VAR, we got some as well through some of our programs. So we
definitely
can help.
Yep. I worked briefly in the VARGov space a little bit last year while I was still in my business development role. And there's a lot of value to it.
Yeah.
I will say that.
There really
is. I found there to be a lot of value into being able to tap in there and get some access to opportunities that are out there in the space. The only other thing I would add maybe is I kind of wanted to mention this a little bit in the SLED conversation. We really didn't get to that point, but the educational side of things too. There's been a strong commitment and discussion about getting schools reopened as soon as possible, like fully reopened, not just back and forth and trying to sort it out.
Yeah.
I think Biden even recently mentioned wanting K-8 to be back full time as soon as possible within the next month or so.
And maybe is that the cascade you were talking about, Jeff? That if this bill gets passed, you know, there's cascading dollars that'll come down to the local level, and education, to your point, John, I think is one of those areas that's going to see a significant increase in funding, correct?
Absolutely. I completely believe that if you look back at that, you know, 70% number of public sector IT officials, right? I can almost tell you that especially even in Fairfax County, Virginia, one of the wealthiest counties in all the country from a school board standpoint, they have struggled. They've struggled with their Blackboard system. They've struggled with tools that they had purchased that were to enable remote connectivity. And the other thing is training, right? The teachers don't know, the educators are not used to teaching in a virtual environment. Some of them have for 20 or 30 years have been in the classroom environment, not in the virtual environment. And so, you know, there's a huge opportunity there for technology to become an enabler.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned the Blackboard thing. It's one of those words that always makes me cringe. I used to work in educational publishing, and this has been going on 6-7 years ago. And the company I worked for was very much trying to push into the digital space and digital courses. And I know they've done very well for themselves over the last year because of that, you know, for an unfortunate reason. But there's still, you know, the fact that you even mentioned something like that tells me that there's still these fundamental problems in education of how to teach students at the college level and definitely in the K through 12 level if they're not actually physically in the school. We saw that blow up in the worst way over the last year. And again, you know, obviously we don't plan on there being a pandemic again anytime soon where we have to pivot the same way. But I think a lot of schools also realize, like, hey, there's a way we can get out of having snow days and making
students... I was just about to go there. Yeah. Snow days are gone. Snow days are a thing of the future.
If you can do NTI at home, why would you worry about snow days?
Yeah.
Or more importantly, like, let's say at the college level, you know, a student that maybe can't afford to come, you know, live on campus, but wants to attend a school that's far away from them, and maybe there's still opportunities for them to do that remotely.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of money. There's a lot of, well, not a lot of money, but there hopefully will be a lot of money soon. But there's a lot of opportunity available there that as these schools try to figure this out, that is something I think you should be going in there and talking to these folks and asking them, hey, I know you probably have been through hell over the last year. Let's talk about how we can make sure that's never a problem again as we move forward.
Start building those relationships, as Jeff said. There you go.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's wrap up then with our favorite question of every week, which is what's tech connecting with us? This is where we just, you know, quickly talk about a piece of technology, something in the world of science or information or innovation that has caught our eye or our attention this week. Jeff, I'll let you start. What is tech connecting with you right now?
Well, artificial intelligence is really, really hot right now. And the reason that it's getting a lot of attention from Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security is because we cannot afford to not implement AI tools that protect our warfighter and that protect our country. And so there is going to be a race from an implementation standpoint and a utilization standpoint of how to leverage AI to do many things, but mainly help us better manage information, complex databases, and get ahead of our foreign and domestic people that don't want to do the right thing for our, you know, IT environments.
Yeah,
definitely.
Gotcha.
Just whatever you do, if anyone's consulting you about it, don't let them name it Skynet. Okay.
Yes, true.
Just a bad idea. I don't care what it is. Just don't let them run with that name.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need to make all that come true.
When did that awake, by the way? Have we passed that year? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Like the official, like, judgment day was, I don't know, it was like mid-2000s or something,
okay.
I think.
So, yeah. So we're good.
Yeah. We're good.
All right.
All right, Dee, what's tech connected with you right now?
Well, I had a couple of them, but here's the one that's of most interest to me right now. Did you know?
Tech disconnected.
Oh, yeah, you're good. You're good, Jeff. Slime. Okay. And I'm not talking about slime that you see on TV shows.
Not Nickelodeon,
but like
slime.
Organic slime.
Okay.
Did you know that slime has memory? But even
Feel like I did kind of know that. Maybe.
Okay, it doesn't have a brain, but slime has memory, and they've proven it. That you know, I guess, and I kind of dug down a little bit, and slime is, you know, I guess technically it's polycyphalum. It's, you know, it's like the single cell, but then it can branch out and it has little tubes that go towards the food. And you know what the test that they run is, you know, when the tubes go to food that they don't, that it doesn't like or can't consume, it remembers that, and so it kind of shuts down some of its capabilities of doing that, and it shifts its resources towards food sources that it can. So, again, it doesn't have a brain, but it does have a memory, so that the next time it comes in contact with food that maybe it had a negative reaction to, it won't send its little feeding tubes out there. It'll go towards something else. So, anyway, did you know that slime had memory?
For some reason, I feel like this is something I had actually stumbled across at some point.
Well, fair enough. I did not know that.
Maybe in a science fiction context, because the Blob.
Possible that you came across this, because apparently this has been a perplexing issue for microbiologists for decades, right? And they're just now starting to prove some of this stuff and get a little bit of insight on it.
Well, I do feel like the microscopic world is as perplexing and fascinating and endlessly deep places that we don't know about just as much as outer spaces.
100%. Isn't that weird?
It really
is.
Are
we in the middle? I mean, like,
I guess
it's like
we
infinitely
are,
big, you know, the universe and infinitely small.
Yeah, I guess so.
What is up with that?
Like, we've figured out all this stuff, but there's things,
It's kind of cool. What's tech connecting with you?
So for me,
we got AI and slime covered. What else you got?
I'm gonna talk about self-driving vehicles again, because it's one of those things that always just catches my attention.
We going level five or whatever?
Yeah, you know, I desperately want my self-driving car, and I have a feeling that's not gonna happen in my lifetime.
It has to happen, because I was just thinking about this myself, that when I retire, you know, in whatever 15, 20 years or something like that, I would love to be in a self-driving car that just, where do you want to go? Oh, Grand Canyon. Boop.
All right. Well, to that end, here's a headline from GeekWire. As Amazon's Zooks unveils passenger robo-taxi, CEO acknowledges potential for package delivery. So basically, it's just a conversation about how, you know, all these giant tech companies are all trying their
hand. They're dumping money into
at all things autonomous vehicles.
Yes.
So, and Amazon has been working on a robo-taxi. Well, they acquired a robo-taxi company called Zooks.
Do I have this visually correct? Am I seeing a robot in the driver's seat?
No, it doesn't actually a robot, but it's just an automated vehicle. What I find interesting about it, I don't know if you watched the HBO Westworld series at all. Mm-hmm. There are autonomous vehicles they show in that this thing looks suspiciously like. And again, it's one of those things. I don't want to make that correlation because Westworld is like kind of like that, you know, technology gone amok and
got it. Yes,
you know, killing
we all
humans
die,
kind of
right?
Thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. But this is basically just like a compact bus that basically has like two benches in it, you know, that facing each other, where four people could take a ride somewhere together.
All right.
So they are working pretty heavily on this. They're feeling good about it. It says passengers will be able to use an app to hail the vehicle. It's bi-directional. It's a symmetrical vehicle that's bi-directional, so it can operate the same in
either
both
way.
Directions.
Yep.
Either way, it doesn't matter. It has an automated turning system designed to maneuver in and out of tight spots, minimizing three-point turns and U-turns.
Oh, those wheels, like, they can just turn. You can, like, slide right into a slot.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Fits up to four people with sliding doors on both sides, primarily envisioned for short rides in urban environments. It is also capable of driving on highways at speeds of up to 75 miles per hour.
There you go.
So, you know, it kind of makes me think about this thing. And, you know, we've talked about this several times on the show. Again, I don't know that you and I are ever going to have our own personal autonomous vehicle.
I don't know.
But I do think we probably, within the next, let's say, 25, 30 years, we'll have rideshare type vehicles.
We got to be there, right? I mean, we got to be there. Yeah. I mean, with where we're at today and just the amount of money that's being dumped into that, you know, the whole thing. If we don't figure it out in like 5 to 10 years, let's just put it this way. If we don't figure it out, all right, we got to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, this
like
says
flying cars or hovercraft or something.
Yeah,
that's
a whole other world there. This says the interior includes wireless phone charging pads, a moonroof, built-in screens for checking trip status and playing music. I mean,
yeah, that's where I want to be.
That sounds cool.
That sounds pretty darn cool.
I'm all for that. Yeah.
Can I do that across the country? And then I'm.
It's probably a little shorter range.
Yeah, but, you said shorter.
Again, well,
and things.
Let's be honest. This probably has applications when it comes to mass transit in some way too.
Oh, 100%.
You know, I feel like we've kind of fallen off the discussion about like the maglev trains and the high speed super trains and superconductors. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff doesn't seem like it's going as fast as it should be. So maybe this is kind of the future of you know, mass transit of some sort. Even if it's not mass, it's, you know, but, you know,
it fits into the big cities. And I think that's the problem that U.S. has right now, and that we're not developing quite like China. I mean, yeah, China, they've been like, you know, exponential growth over the last 15, 20 years maybe. So everything's new over there. So, yeah, you can put in a high-speed rail between this city and this city because there was nothing there, you know, beforehand. But anyway,
Well, and let's be honest, this is one of those things that probably starts tapping into potentially even public sector, honestly. I could see that being involved because I think the smart city angle of things will come into play here, where in order for these vehicles to feel safe and maneuver around, you're going to want them in a smart city environment. Ironically, and we'll save that for another show about smart cities, I just read an article today about how like a lot of that smart city efforts is kind of falling apart in a lot of places.
Are we going to need Jeff's help unpacking smart cities?
What's your experience of smart cities? Because we might bring you back for that episode.
Well, yeah, I think it was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, we did an entire 2 day event on smart cities to try to help our partners get ahead of the technology.
Maybe the end thing will look a little bit different, but I'm still in on these automated cars. I mean, I feel like, I know that's how you started us off here, but I do feel like I'm feeling a little bit more hopeful than you are. I feel like I'm going to be in a car someday in my life that there's no driver. You know, there's just no driver. And I'm not in Disney World. Because can you have that already at Disney World? Or hop in some kind of automated little thing? All right.
All right. Well, put a pin in that, Jeff. We will probably bring you back to talk about smart cities.
Yeah, we're bringing him back for several reasons.
That is a topic that has been one topic I wanted to talk about. Yeah, definitely. Yep. Well, thank you so much for your time today. We very much appreciate having you on the show. Again, folks, you can expect to hear from Jeff again. We have plenty more discussions about the world of government. Obviously, now smart cities is on the agenda. So he might just become one of our recurring guests this year. So, but hey, it is time for us to unplug. I want to, as always, thank our amazing producer, Mark Ryan, who helps us out with the editing and behind the scenes work.
He's a really good guy. Exactly. He does. He does a lot behind the scenes for us.
As well as our researcher, Sam Claney. We appreciate their help in making this show possible. So until next time, everybody, please stay in. Across industries, Zebra scanners see more, powering businesses to see more as well. Easy-to-read barcodes are, in reality, a rarity. From warehouses to stores and in hospitals, Zebra scanners can read challenging barcodes, ensuring productivity, efficiency, customer satisfaction, and patient safety. The What Can You See campaign includes marketing and sales enablement like a scanner selection tool and flyers that will help you and your customers see Zebra barcode scanners in a whole new light. To learn more, check out the link in the show notes or visit Zebra's microsite on bluestarinc.com.